Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 123. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two incredibly different movies, and I say that often, but this time it's true. First off, we have from 1964, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, which is an old favourite of many people and is widely regarded as one of the worst movies of all time. Then we go from there to a movie more recent, but which is a lot harder in a lot of ways. And that is 2013's The Purge, an American dystopian horror film starring Ethan Hawke and Lena Headey. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get on with this really kind of split personality episode of the podcast. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction, of horror, or fantasy, or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Okay, so how the hell is everybody? It's warm here. It's lovely and warm. Summer has come in, and the weather, as is the case here in the second decade of the 21st century, is chaotic and unprecedented and weird in a number of ways. It's happened to everybody around the world, but certain people in power deny it. Anyway, I did... there was a Patreon thing. I haven't mentioned it on Martian, but I did mention it on Paleo Cinema. Patreon were planning to add service fees from the customers, from the subscribers' end of the deal. So if you donated a dollar to Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In Podcast, and all strength to you if you did, then you'd be paying about $1.39. This caused an immense ruction among the people, both the people who are donating to other podcasts and the people who are running podcasts and like to get money from their listeners and other, you know, other creative people. Some people do it with blogs. I know some people are doing it with fiction as well. But all of the content creators were pretty upset about it. So the way I reacted to it was kind of atypical and a bit weird. But then that's no surprise to anyone that I react that way to things. So I decided that what I would do is if I got 10 extra Patreon subscribers or other subscribers, I would review and do a special podcast for Star Wars The Last Jedi. And I would actually see it. So Patreon then changed its mind, which was really nasty of them because I was already committed to this course of action by this stage. And so I decided, because Patreon had backed off, I'd back off a little bit. And I said, I will get, if I get 5 more subscribers, then I will do it. Sally was the 5th one. She gave me $12, said, here's a year's subscription at $1 a month. You now have to go and see Star Wars The Last Jedi and review it on a podcast. Ha, ha, ha. And I did. And I actually got another subscriber as well, which is always nice. But, so I ended up with 6 extra subscribers. A couple of people paid me through PayPal instead of Patreon. And that's always an option if you're interested in availing yourself of that option and just dropping some dough. Send me a Facebook message or a message through feedbackpaleo@gmail.com. More than happy to give you the details that will enable you to do that. So anyway, I had to go and see the movie. So I went and saw the movie, and there were good and bad things in it, I'll be honest with you. I did promise everybody I would be as objective as I can be when watching the movie. And I actually recorded the podcast and next week, just before Santa Claus arrives, everybody will be getting it on the Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In feed. But for the week after I recorded it, the Patreon subscribers and those people who donated by other means got access to it a week early. It just seemed a reasonable thing that the people who were coughing up the money got things a little bit earlier. So I'll be putting that on the stream for both Paleo and Martian probably about Christmas Eve. So I did it, and I did it by alternating. Here's a good thing about the movie, here's a bad thing about the movie. It's the only way I could really approach it. And so I did about 40 minutes on that, uploaded it, and that's part of what I was doing this week. But apart from that, and I'm not going to talk about what I thought of the movie, wait until you hear the special podcast, which is an extra one, not part of the normal rotation. So apart from that, what have I been doing? Let's see. I did see another Joe Orton adaptation, because I did a Joe Orton-based movie, Entertaining Mr. Sloan, for Paleo Cinema last week. And it was Loot, which starred Howell Bennett. It also had Richard Attenborough in it and Lee Remick. It's a kind of farce about how nasty the coppers are. Joe Orton originally wrote it because he was in jail for 6 months for defacing library books, because he and his partner, Kenneth Halliwell, had a habit of defacing and making artistic some library books and then sending them back to the library with dirty pictures on them and things like that. Those very library books are now in various art galleries around England. So I watched Loot. It was fun. It's a stupid farce, and it's dumb, and it's funny, and it's really a little bit strange. But I watched that, and it was a lot of fun. I think it's from about 1971. I did rewatch one of the pilots that Gene Roddenberry did after the first Star Trek series completed, which was A Quest of Tapes with Mike Farrell in it, and it has a lot of other people in it. Lou Ayres is in it, and Dana Winter, and a bunch of others. It's about an android who's created to kind of guide human race through the chaotic period in the next number of years. It wasn't a bad pilot. It's a bit like Spectre, the other pilot that really is outstanding that Roddenberry did, that should have gone to series but never did. And I enjoyed rewatching that. It does show its a lot of the characters are slightly two-dimensional. It very much in tune with the state-of-the-art in 1970s American television. But, yeah, I enjoyed rewatching it. I did do a recommendation from our good friend Grant Watson on a movie I should see. Johnny Hallyday, who was a French pop singer, he was considered to be almost the French Elvis, died a week and a half ago. And so I said, Valet Johnny Hallyday, because I knew him from his music. And Grant said, you should see the movie he did with Johnny Toe in Hong Kong called Vengeance from 2009. So I had a couple of bucks in the PayPal account, so I bought a copy of that and watched it. It's a really great concept, and it's really well executed, as indeed are a number of the characters. The story's pretty simple. Johnny Hallyday plays a French restaurateur who's a retired hitman. His daughter and his son-in-law and his grandchildren are the victims of a hit in Hong Kong. His daughter is severely wounded and needs to be repatriated to France during the course of the film, but his grandchildren and his son-in-law were killed. So he goes to Hong Kong and decides he's going to get revenge. He's going to find out who wounded his daughter, killed his grandchildren and son-in-law, and do something about it. And he meets up almost by accident with three hitmen and hires them by giving them everything he owns, his restaurant in France, everything he owns, to help him get revenge. There's a twist, though. He is suffering from a form of dementia because of a bullet wound to the head he suffered many years before, and he's becoming increasingly forgetful. So he's got a limited time to get this stuff done, and his mind's deteriorating. So it's a great concept for a crime film and an action film, and it's really well executed. Johnny Toe does a fantastic job of it, and I really enjoyed that movie. So if you get a chance to see Vengeance, it's worth it. It really doesn't play the way, say, an American movie of this type would,
but it works. It really does hit all the buttons, and Johnny Hallyday is really good in it. I did also, while we're on the Asian side of things, I did rewatch Mr. Vampire, which is one of the kind of seminal Jiang Xue movies with Chinese hopping vampires in it. It's a comedy. It's got some incredibly acrobatic martial arts in it. It's got one character who falls in love with a female ghost. You've got another one who's turning into a Jiang Xue. You've got their master. You've also got a priest. And a whole bunch of other people. There's a love interest in there, and there's a lot of fun. It's probably the classic, the seminal Jiang Xue movie, and it's a lot of fun to revisit and rewatch, so I enjoyed that too. And then just to change things up, I watched Seven Brides for Seven Brothers again. Howard Keel, Jane Powell, and some of the best dance choreography of MGM's entire oeuvre, all choreographed by Michael Kidd. It's fantastic stuff. And rewatching it again was a lot of fun. It was, you know, just casual, friendly, nice MGM musical for me to watch. But apart from that, I haven't really been doing too much. Just chilling out, taking things easy. There's the seasonal rush. Did go to a party at a good friend Jamie's place and met up with a lot of people and caught up with some people I hadn't seen in a long time. So yesterday was in the sunshine under a marquee, eating some fantastic food, drinking a little bit of alcohol, not too much because I was driving, and catching up with people. And one thing I noticed, and this is a sociological scientific thing, so it's sort of Martian driving-y. I was talking with a whole bunch of people more or less my age, and there's a common thread that goes through everything that's being said, and maybe this is the times changing and us not adapting to it. I'm willing to believe that. But there are a lot of people, not necessarily only my age, but there are a lot of people out there who are really disillusioned with the way capitalism and business works in our society, and who really think that working more and more for less and less money is going to fuck things up big time, and people are really tired of it. They're exhausted, they're mentally worn down by it and psychologically worn down by it, and things have to change. I mean, for me, I'm kind of out of that rat race now, which is an interesting place to be. I get the feeling there's still the urge to be back in the rat race and doing the 9-to-5, but at this stage I don't have to, and so I'm trying to find the next phase of my life, and I'm in the process of that. I've already done some of it. The trip to Sydney I took as a part of it. But it was interesting to see a lot of my own thoughts and feelings about the way the world, at least in a business sense, works, and reflected by a number of other people unprompted. So there really is a thing where you can get brainwashed by certain kinds of businesses you work for. And occasionally you have a moment of clarity when you think, no, that's not how my life should be. That's not how I should be working. I should be doing the things I'm passionate about rather than the things I have to do. And I think that the world would be a better and a happier place if we could move toward that rather than move toward, in a sense, greed and staying on the hamster treadmill, the hamster wheel, and just keep running and running and running to stay in the same place. So that was kind of interesting, that conversation. There was a lot of good stuff too. Catching up with people, finding out how they work creatively was a lot of fun. I did talk to a fairly well-known fantasy writer, a friend of mine, and she told me about her work process and how the cash flow ebbs and flows depending on how much she works, how many books she puts out. The changes that are in place because of ebooks that do change the business models for the creative people. So there was a lot of good meaty conversation there, and it really is a refreshing and a lovely thing to be a part of that. And it was the party was partly for my good friend Jamie's 50th birthday, and he made a speech which paralleled that and talked about how he loves his friends because a lot of us do creative work and we're passionate about things and we really like things and we really follow our hearts in a lot of ways, and how that's an inspiration to other people, and it's the kind of people you want to hang around with. You want to hang around with people who have a passion for things. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, if it's football, I'm probably not going to be interested, but they're passionate about the things they're doing. They're engaged with the world politically and socially and all the other ways. And that's probably the way to lead in this benighted time. Life of satisfaction is to stay engaged and stay passionate. Find your passion. Do it as much as you can within other limitations. There are family commitments, of course, and there are work commitments. But follow your passions, definitely, and be a part of the conversation about them. So that was a kind of an inspiring thing for me, and it renewed my passion for what I do, and it was a lot of fun. The other thing, one last piece of news before I get on with the movies. I'm doing the radio gig again next year. I talked to Michaela Simpson, with whom I'm doing the ABC Northern Territory chat about movies every fortnight, and we're continuing it. We're going to do it for another year. I don't know how long this is going. I hope it goes until I step on a rainbow. But yeah, we're doing it for another year, and that's great, and I love that. And we got some ideas about what we want to talk about. And so every fortnight I'd troll into Melbourne town, go into a little booth at ABC headquarters, and just talk movies with somebody who's interested in movies too. And hopefully we keep entertaining people across 1.4 million square kilometres of the Northern Territory. So I'm happy about that. That always pleases me when I get renewed. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies, which is the world-famous and much-beloved by many people in spite of its quality, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Santa sets up a fantastic automatic toy factory on Mars. The Martian leader battles the wicked Vodar in a desperate effort to save Santa, the wise man of Mars. 900 years old. The Battle of the Toys, when Martian kids and Earth kids join Santa to battle the bad guys of Mars. For real space age fun, you'll be out of this world when Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians is a 1964 American science fiction comedy, it says here in Wikipedia, directed by Nicholas Webster, who also directed a lot of episodic television. People say it is one of the worst movies of all time, which is a possibility, though I think it's well-meaning rather than just cack-handed. A lot of it was filmed in a very small studio around New York using actors from Broadway, which was kind of interesting. It stars John Call as Santa Claus, and also, most notably of all, Pia Zadora as one of the Martian children, Girma. See, she's a girl Martian. Bomar is her brother, is boy Martian. Kimar, her father, is the king Martian. And the Momar is the mother Martian. So that's the kind of thinking that this particular film engendered, which is kind of lame. There are a lot of science fiction tropes from way, way back that appear in this movie. But for people of my generation, it was a perennial Christmas film on television, because I think it may well be in the public domain. If it's not, it should be. And it has that kind of... there's a concept there of what kids would enjoy in the 1960s as children in an entertainment. Now, it wasn't always the case. We wanted to see other stuff. And we're an unfortunate generation in a lot of ways compared to later generations, because children's media in the time in which I grew up didn't have fart jokes. It didn't have poo jokes. It didn't have any of those transgressive things, even though we did think that poos and farts were funny. But it was a different time, and unfortunately, we, in spite of the fact that we got into the cinemas very cheaply and a lot of other things, we had a lot better than later generations. We got told to go out and play in the streets until the streetlights came on summer nights. None of this helicopter parenting stuff. In spite of all those freedoms we had, we also had pretty shitty media in a lot of ways. And I fully acknowledge that fact. It's sad but true. A lot of particularly children's media from the 1950s and 1960s, it was pretty piss poor and ordinary. Nonetheless, this one, when I mentioned that this one was going to be going out there, I got messages from a number of people going, oh, I loved that when I was a kid. And that's an interesting meme that I'm going to explore a little bit more. If you're interested, the whole of Santa Claus Conquers the Martians is on YouTube, as are an increasing number of older things, of course. And it's a pretty good copy as such things go. So that's the one I watched. I didn't bother dragging out the DVD I've got. I just went to YouTube and watched it. And rewatching it was a kind of weird experience because it wasn't very good. It didn't draw my attention as much as I expected it to. But nonetheless, it's a part of movie history. It's a part of my history with movies. So I'll do the best I can to kind of tell you what worked about it, what didn't work about it. Story's pretty simple. People on Mars, including Momar and Kemar, are worried that their children are watching too much Earth television, notably a TV station called Kid TV, which interviewed Santa Claus at his workshop. They consult an ancient 800-year-old Martian sage called Chochum, which is a Yiddish word meaning genius, and I'm reading this from Wikipedia. And they're advised that the children of Mars are growing distracted due to society's overly rigid structure. From infancy, all their education is fed into their brains through machines, and they're not allowed individuality or freedom of thought. Important meme there. He notes that this has been coming for centuries and says the only way to help the children is to allow them their freedom and to be allowed to have fun. To do this, they need a Santa Claus figure like on Earth. Leaving Chochum's cave, the Martian leaders decide to abduct Santa Claus from Earth and bring him to Mars, because obviously that's the easiest way of doing it. The Martians check out Earth. They see tons and tons of Santa Clauses on street corners and all sorts of other places, and they kidnap two children to help them find the real one. The two children, who are very not memorable, are Victor Stiles, as Billy, and Donna Conforti as Betty. They're kind of generic kids, and not professional actors, but generic kids. They help the Martians find Santa. They take him to Mars, and there's an attempted coup on Mars by the evil Voldar, played with an enormous and very, very impressive mustache by an actor called Vincent Beck. And as Santa does an automated workshop on Mars, she gets real, and Voldar eventually gets overthrown. Meanwhile, there's a kind of comic character on Mars called Droppo, who's a friend of the children, and is clearly going to be the guy who ends up being the Martian Santa Claus. He's played by a guy called Bill McCutcheon, who's really interesting for a couple of reasons. One of which is he ends up being Santa Claus on Mars. That's a pretty impressive one. So props to him for that. The other thing, which is really, really interesting, is in later life, he won a Tony Award for playing a character called Moonface Martin in the musical Anything Goes on Broadway, which is kind of impressive. I mean, you go from playing a comic relief Martian on Santa Claus Conquers the Mars to winning a Tony Award as Best Supporting Actor in a Musical Role. Now, Bill McCutcheon didn't go straight from one to the other. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians was made in 1964. He won the Tony Award in the 1987 Broadway revival of Anything Goes. So that was pretty impressive. So, you know, he was around as a jobbing actor for a lot of years. And 33 years after playing an idiot, basically, in Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, he won a Tony Award. So all props to Bill McCutcheon. Terrific effort there. The other person we know, of course, is Pia Zadora, who plays one of the Martian children, Gilma. And Pia Zadora, we know from her movie career, which she only did in a total of 9 movies and 4 TV roles, but she became a bit of a punchline. I mean, she was in a really bad 1983 movie called The Lonely Lady. She was in Butterfly with Stacy Keach. The Lonely Lady is really a weird movie in a lot of ways. If you get a chance to see it, do. I really should try to do it for Paleo Cinema Podcast at some stage. But it was directed by Peter Sasti, who did the Nigel Neal script at the Stone Tapes in 1972, and also directed Taste the Blood of Dracula, Count of Dracula, and Hands of the Ripper. Lonely Lady is basically a Romana Clay kind of thing about a female actor in Hollywood. She starts out as an innocent schoolgirl in the San Fernando Valley and meets a whole bunch of people, and then ends up being nominated for an Oscar and basically swears on stage during the Oscar things. I haven't seen this movie for a long time, but I really should try to find a copy of The Lonely Lady, because it is low-level trash all the way through, based on a Harold Robbins novel, which gives you a bit of an indication. But that is Pia Zadora as an adult. As a child, she was in Santa Claus Conquers the Martians and doesn't really leave an impression. She only gets a few lines of dialogue, mostly sits there wearing a thing that looks like a scuba diving mask on her head and a couple of antennas with green face paint and a leotard. Everybody on Mars wears green, more or less green leotards, which is kind of cheap costuming, if you ask me. And they also have really weird belts. But there are a lot of other science fiction tropes on Mars. Everybody doesn't eat food. They eat pills for food, which is supposed to be real food. You know, this one's dessert, this one's beef and potatoes, that kind of thing. Which is such a cliche. Even in 1964, it was a cliche in science fiction circles. And scientifically, it's totally fucked too, because if you're living on pills for food, your digestive system's going to end up looking like an umbilical cord. So, yeah, not a particularly good idea. It came from, I think, about 1920s, 1930s in written science fiction, and was quickly dismissed because of exactly the reasons I just mentioned. Your digestive system would totally root itself and you'd die. But it's one of those things that stuck around in audiovisual science fiction, TV and movies, for a crazy long time. I think it was in Conquest of Space as well, and a bunch of other movies like that. But it really is an incredibly dated and silly science fiction concept. But we do also get some really bad and interesting things. There's a scene near the North Pole where the children run away to try to warn Santa Claus that the Martians are coming to get him. And there's a really bad polar bear who is monstering them, which is basically a guy in a polar bear suit. And it's very obvious that it's a guy in a polar bear suit, which makes it even more comical. Again, it shows a kind of naive sweetness of this movie. It wasn't a big budget film by any means. And you can tell by the size of the sets and the angles used to film the movie that the set itself wasn't much larger than a lounge room in a lot of cases. And they kind of had to work around that limitation. But having said that, the interesting thing for me is that idea of people retaining a fondness for things they saw as a child, even though they're not very good. Now, I'm not going to bash on Star Wars. I'm just going to mention this as a phenomenon in relation to Star Wars, because I find it interesting, but not particularly surprising. But I think that there's a really unusual thing. If we saw a movie, or even a movie series in the case of Star Wars, when we were at a certain sweet spot age as a child, we are fond of whatever comes after that. I've of course had my disagreements with Star Wars fans who are uncritical of the franchise and who see a new Star Wars movies and movie and suddenly they're 7 years old again and turn off any evaluative facilities in their minds and really don't kind of go, okay, well, this one's good. This doesn't work. The plot doesn't work. This bit works. Yeah, none of that kind of weighing up that we do when we see a new film happens in the minds of some Star Wars fans. And movies like Santa Claus Conquers the Martians are probably a bit the same way. I find it fascinating that that occurs. And one of the other interesting things is, in that regard, is there is a backlash against the Star Wars franchise. And it's not coming from boomers like me who are a little too old to be drinkers of the Kool-Aid when it comes to that particular series. But it's coming from people who are in their 20s. It's coming from, a lot of it's coming from millennials and, you know, Generation Z kind of people who watch this stuff now and who grew up immersed in media studies and things like that. And they really are having a serious backlash against movies that a lot of people who are maybe Gen X really, really love. They're kind of going, okay, well, this doesn't work. This was crap. There are a whole bunch of people out there who aren't trolling. They're actually seriously looking at the movies, but really don't have the same emotional entanglement in the sense of quantum entanglement that an older generation has to this particular franchise. Yes, it's going to make a lot of money, and little kiddies are going to buy the toys and all that kind of thing. But nonetheless, there is a disengagement there, which is kind of interesting to me. And I wonder whether that's going to continue, because there are kids' things out now, things like Adventure Time, which is underlying the stuff that kids will enjoy in Adventure Time. There is a complex psychological plot. There are kind of subtexts and interesting tropes in Adventure Time that give it that extra level of complexity. So I think that media's changed because in the effort to make something that's engaging to both children and adults, and by giving it that extra layering the way that something like Adventure Time does, it really does mean that when people reevaluate a series like that in the future, they're going to find those levels and they're going to find those subtexts. They're going to find those romantic entanglements and all the other little bits of and pieces of stuff that really weren't obvious to them when they were children. Children's cinema and children's television has changed enormously since the early days, and people putting real care and regard into TV series that are ostensibly for children really are doing a service to future generations and also to the reviewing of what they do by their audience when their audience grows up. So it's going to be an interesting time in the next 20 years, say, when people start going, hey, remember Adventure Time? I went back and I rewatched that and I didn't understand all those layers. I didn't understand the complexity of the characters. I didn't understand that it was a post-apocalyptic world and that Finn and Jake are doing this and that. In a sense, the things like that are future-proofed because they do have Easter eggs that only reveal themselves as the audience grows older. Whereas something as simplistic as Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, or that franchise I just mentioned, really doesn't at its heart have those layers and have those surprises that come with reviewing at a different time of people's lives. But nonetheless, it was good to revisit it. It was good to go, okay, well, I'm going to watch this one again. And yes, it's silly, and yes, it's dumb. And the jokes are pitched at maybe a four-year-old's level, where if people fall down or something crazy happens, like a teddy bear ends up with a doll's head and the doll ends up with a teddy bear's head because someone messes with Santa Claus's toy machine. That kind of stuff plays well to a four-year-old, but anybody above that age these days, it really isn't going to engage. I'm not even sure that children now would sit still and watch something like Santa Claus Conquers the Martians because it's pitched at people of another generation who and over time this happens, who are from another culture. My childhood isn't the same as the childhood of somebody 20 or 30 years later. Of course, I had an abusive childhood, so I hope it isn't anyway. But culturally, and in a pop culture sense as well, I come from a different culture than many, many other people who are younger than I am. And you've got to appreciate that. So in a sense, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians is an artifact from another culture that is a little bit opaque to people who weren't there at the time. You know, you weren't there, man. That kind of thing. But nonetheless, it was worth revisiting. And the theme tune, which I'm going to play for you now, does have a certain chirpy silliness about it, which makes me, in spite of the quality of the movie, a little bit nostalgic. So that's enough Martian Yuletide silliness. I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to be talking about a very, very different movie from 2013, which is The Purge, starring Ethan Hawke and Lena Headey.
People a release for all the hatred and violence that they keep up inside them.
Why don't you guys kill someone tonight?
Because we don't feel the need to, Johnny.
Just remember all the good the Purge does.
Warning, the annual Purge has commenced. For the next 12 hours, all crime is legal. Your government thanks you for your participation.
Help me! Someone, please, help me!
I just need to get somewhere safe. Does anybody hear me?
Let's go! This way!
Tony!
This way, hurry!
Why did you let him in our home? We have no idea who's after him.
Our target for this year's purge is hiding in your home. You have 1 hour to find him and give him to us. Or we'll kill all of you.
They can't get in here, right? They can't get into our home.
Everything is gonna be okay.
Nothing is ever going to be okay again.
The Purge starts June 7th.
The Purge is a 2013 American dystopian horror film. It was written and directed by James DeMonaco and is the first in the Purge franchise. There have been three movies so far, Purge Anarchy and The Purge Election Year, which were released in 2014 and 2016 respectively. And there is a fourth title, The Purge, The Island, which is a prequel to the three Purge movies that we've had so far, which is due to be released on the 4th of July, 2018. There's also talk of a TV series. So this is a very successful franchise. The movie was made for about $3 million and it ended up making about $48 million in the box office, which is pretty good. Sorry, $89 million, I apologize. $89 million on a $3 million budget. So they definitely got their bait back when they went fishing with this one. The story is kind of simple and horrible and is also a critique, of course, of American gun culture and that side of the American political character that longs for simple solutions to very complex social problems. The movie is set in 2022, but it posits a future where in 2014, a group called the New Founding Fathers of America, which is a totalitarian political party, took over the American government after an economic collapse and passed the 28th Amendment, which sanctions an annual national civic tradition called the Purge, the first of which is supposed to have taken place in 2017. Here's how the Purge goes down. Sirens blare throughout the country to signal the start and the end of the Purge. All police, fire and medical emergency services remain unavailable or suspended for the 12-hour purge period. Government officials with authorization levels of ranking 10 or higher are granted immunity, a rule which gets revoked in the purge the election year. Weapons of class 4 and below are permitted for use, while class 5 weaponry, explosive devices such as grenades, rocket launchers, bazookas, etc., weapons of mass destruction, and viral, biological, and chemical agents is prohibited. Public hanging is a penalty for violating any of the rules. So basically, for 12 hours once a year, there is no law, and you can kill anybody you like, torture anybody you like, basically do what you want, because the new founding fathers of America decided that what they need to do is once a year, let everybody get their angst out and just let them go mad. Now, there's a kind of ugly method to their madness in the sense that it's a way of getting rid of minority groups and people of low socioeconomic circumstances, because they're the people who don't have the resources to protect themselves and to bunker down during the purge. So there's a kind of social engineering writ large in the whole concept of the purge. Now, the first movie, which stars Ethan Hawke, Lena Headey, Adelaide Kane, and Max Burkholder as the Sandon family, their father, James Sandon, sells protection systems for the purge. So he basically sells the means for upper middle class people in his neighborhood to protect themselves from the purge. You know, enormous screens covering their doors, security systems of various kinds, surveillance systems around the houses, and all of the wherewithal that they need to not become victims to the purge. It goes wrong in 2022 on March 21st, which is the date of the purge. James Sandon, his wife Mary, and their children Zoe and Charlie hunker down. They're not going to be part of the purge. They're not going to go out and kill anybody they can kill. They just want to survive the night and get through it. Their neighbors are having a purge party, for whatever that means, and they find out quite soon what that means. So the purge starts in the evening, and the family had some guns and security systems and cameras around. And the son, Charlie, sees a wounded black man staggering down the street asking for help. And being the compassionate kid he is, even though he does run a very monstered up little mobile drone, ground drone, kind of remote controlled surveillance system toy through the house, which is really fucking ugly and also has infrared capabilities. He's a kind of kind-hearted kid who opens up the security system long enough for the man to get into their fairly large and rambling ranch home. That character, who unfortunately doesn't get a name and is known as the Bloody Stranger, is played by Edwin Hodge. He hides and writes in his own blood on the wall, "Don't try to find me." So the family's a bit upset by this, obviously. They've got a stranger in their house during the purge. And that's also complicated by the fact that Zoe's boyfriend sneaks into the house before the lockdown for the purge and wants to make out with her, and also because her father disapproves of him, kill the father. So that starts the ball rolling. And then there's escalation as well. A whole bunch of purges who are up on basically wealthy guys, young men and women. The women are wearing cocktail frocks and scary masks. The men are wearing blazers, upper class kind of, you know, blazers with a badge on the breast, and are polite but essentially psychopathic. So basically the 1%. They come to the door of the Sandon's house and say, "We had a person that we were going to purge this year, and they are hiding in your house. Give us that person or we will break into your house and kill you all." There's also a kind of hint of sexual violence there as well. It doesn't manifest in the movie. Really, it doesn't. Yeah, you know, there are slight implications, but essentially, where there are no laws, there's that implication that not only is there going to be murder and torture, but there's also going to be sexual violence. So that's the setup in the first part of the plot. There are a couple of twists in it, which work really well. And on the small scale that this movie obviously has to have, because of the low budget, it works very effectively for the simple reason that James DeMonaco does something very smart. Yes, there's violence and there's blood and there's people being stabbed and all those things that you expect from this kind of a horror movie. But what he does quite well is build suspense. This movie does ramp it up really nicely. Where there's not the budget to do the great big gore effects and torture porn, DeMonaco has really made that good decision to make it a suspenseful film. And suspense is something that's sadly lacking in a lot of horror films. You get jump scares and all sorts of other shit like that in most of them. But really, he does use the fact that they've cut the power to the house and that it's all flashlights and shadows to make it really work well as a small budget, effective horror film. By the way, I should mention, the bloody stranger in the film, the character played by Edwin Hodge, he actually has a name, and that character's name is Dwayne Bishop. And he's in all three of the Purge movies. In fact, there's a name change for the character. In the Purge election year, he's known as Dante Bishop. But it's all the same character. And Bishop becomes an anti-purge activist as the series progresses. I didn't know this, but I just checked it out. So that's kind of interesting. The themes of the film are fairly obvious, really. Gun control, the fact that violence to a certain extent is condoned, and the dystopian concept that what people need to do is to get all their fear and anger out once a year and everything will be okay is kind of the sort of conceit that very conservative and very right-wing and alt-right characters seem to think works. Of course, we don't know that it doesn't. The reason people are fearful and people are angry is because the world isn't right for them. There are things in their lives that aren't going correctly, aren't going in ways that increase their happiness and increase their sense of safety. And none of that is going to be cured by a once a year free-for-all, which is the concept of the movie. It's a flawed concept, of course, and the movie makers know this. But again, it's one of those simplistic answers that totalitarian and authoritarian governments really do favour. And there are a couple of reasons why they do. The first one is they think that the electorate's stupid. They think that the electorate wants stupid, simple answers to complex questions. And to be honest, there is a certain percentage of the electorate that do. In Australia, it runs about 8 to 10%, and they're the people who vote for minority xenophobic political parties like One Nation. The other reason authoritarian governments do that kind of thing is because it's less work than actually fixing the root cause of problems. And to be honest with you, the root cause of a lot of our social and political problems, in Australia at least, is neoliberalism and trickle-down economics. The idea that if you give lots of tax breaks and concessions to rich people, then that will flow down through society and everybody will be hunky-dory. Of course, we know that that doesn't happen and that the rich people keep it all for themselves. Not all of them, but most of them. That new Beamer looks attractive. Those investment properties look attractive. You're not going to trickle down any largesse you get from the government if you're a rich person to the people who work for you and to the rest of society. You're going to try to keep as much as you can. Tax avoidance schemes actually run on that very concept. So we've got a dystopia with a flawed concept, but the movie makers know it's a flawed concept. It's not in any way, or by any means, shown as a preferred option. And the Sandin family learn this. They kind of drink the Kool-Aid up to a certain point, particularly James. He sells these protection systems for a living. His family has got wealthy because of it, or at least comfortable because of it. And his moral compass is skewed by the fact that his people are okay. And then till they suddenly are not, of course. And then there's that kind of moral realization that comes to him later in the movie. His wife, played by Lena Headey, starts to buy into the kind of purge ideology. And at the start, she does tell her kids that the purge will make us safe and all that kind of thing. But when confronted with the reality of it and confronted with the need to get information from Bishop, she confronts her own moral compass and realigns it to really be the... There are two people who are the kind of moral core of this film, one of which is Dwayne Bishop, and the other one is Mary Sandin, played by Lena Headey, because they're the two people that really don't buy in to the purge by the end of the movie. Of course, the kids don't either, but, yeah, they're less prominent in this film as far as that's concerned. It's an interesting concept. I like the idea of the purge as an idea. And it is kind of creepy and plausible enough that you can see under certain circumstances that some idiot government may try it. And in the age of Trump, the purge has become a more powerful and scary movie than it was during the Obama administration when it was made. The idea that stupid solutions to important and real problems in society are something that a certain kind of person, should they get into a position of power, would embrace and apply. I mean, there are some incredibly dystopian things going on at the moment, as we all know. The Center for Disease Control can't use certain words in their press releases and in their reports to government, which kind of limit their ability to do good science. And in fact, they have directives from the Trump administration not to do good science as far as their research is concerned, but to do the things that are popular. Now, that's a scarily nasty concept, because the Center for Disease Control and its the other organizations in Australia, CSIRO, and in a number of different countries, scientific organizations, rely on objective evaluation of evidence. And suddenly the Center for Disease Control, which is a very powerful part of that international community looking after. So here are the words that are banned from the Center for Disease Control in America: diversity, fetus, transgender, vulnerable, entitlement, science-based, and evidence-based. They're not allowed to use that when they're requesting funding next year from the American government. That's fucking scary stuff. That's Purge scale scary stuff. So, as I said, as time goes on and as Trump's regime increases in its what the fuck power, the Purge becomes a lot more interesting and a lot more relevant than it was when it originally came out. Now, this kind of movie isn't for everyone. It is violent, it is scary, and it does go to the core of a lot of people's fears, because fear for your family is a very deeply ingrained instinct, and protection of your family is a very deeply ingrained instinct in the human psyche. And so this movie really kind of jabs at that one with a pointy stick, and which is one of the reasons why it's such an effective film. As I said, not a big budget one, not perfect in its execution, but very effective in a lot of ways. And also, as good horror movies sometimes do, it raises moral questions, and it doesn't flinch away from the more confronting aspects of the situation that it sets up, and all credit to it for that. I have seen the second movie in the series, The Purge Anarchy, which stars Frank Grillo, and I like Frank Grillo as an actor. I think that he's one of the up-and-coming action guys, and he's really good at playing working-class tough guys, in a sense, and in the same way that John Bernthal does in a lot of movies. And I'm looking forward to seeing the third one, The Purge Election Year. I'll tell you the story. Here's what happened. At JB Hi-Fi, my go-to shop for buying DVDs and Blu-rays, the original movie, The Purge, was on a 2-for-$20 sale, and they put stickers on it saying 2 discs for $20 on Blu-ray. So somebody in the store had a brain fart and put a 2-for-$20 sticker on the 3-series box set of all 3 Purge movies. So I took it up to the counter and said, this has got the 2 for, you know, look, I put them through, and they said, this one's not 2 for $20. And I said, but you've got a sticker on it saying that it is. I would like it at that price. And they thought about it for maybe 10 seconds and then gave me the 3-disc box set of the Purge movies that we've had so far for $10, essentially. So I was very pleased with that, because I did want to do it for the podcast. I hadn't seen the first one, but I'd seen the second one. But I thought it was an interesting concept to play with. And I may well do the future Purge movies. I might do the second and the third one for future Martian Driving podcasts. Let me know if you'd like me to review those two, because I think that the concept really works. The execution of the concept works, mostly because they ramp up suspense as much as they do horror. And suspense is a lot harder to do than just kind of cutting the head off horror. Trauma can do that. But building up a situation and slowly tightening the screws takes a bit of art and a lot of skill and a very well-written script. And this script is well-written. I really do like it. Again, it was made on a small budget, and the budgets have increased with the Purge movies, not to the extent that they're going to ever be tentpole blockbuster films. They are a certain niche in the market, and they're never going to be enormous. Nonetheless, I think the series works. I think the series is very timely, and also, as it goes on, in the second film particularly, it moves through being just a horror film into being an action film as well. So I recommend The Purge. You can buy it cheaply here in Australia. You may not get as lucky as I did with the 3-series box set, but you can get it. There is an edition of the first movie, at least, which is quite cheap to get here in Australia, and fair enough too. I think it's a horror movie that deserves to have a bit bigger audience than it does, and I really did like the way that it approached the subject matter. So that's about it for this time around. I'm finishing this up at 6:10 in the morning, by the way. I started the podcast yesterday, had some other things I needed to do, and got up at about 4:50 this morning to complete the podcast. So if I sounded a little bit tired, I apologize. I'm about to go off and donate blood today, which I recommend everybody does before the holiday season, because it is a time when blood banks do need our blood. Here in Australia, we don't get paid for it because That would be icky. So all I get for donating my blood is some snacks and a soft drink and maybe a milkshake. But I've been doing it since I was 18 years old, and I'm going to continue to do it as well. If I'm going to spill blood, it's going to be for a good cause rather than just because I'm fucking clumsy, which has been the case in the past. So anyway, I won't do another Martian drive-in before the reindeer shit hits your roof. So everybody have a good Newtonmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, Christmas, whatever you celebrate and however you celebrate it. Definitely have a great one. I know it's a tough time for some people, and I'm really aware of that. And I'm sending out hugs to those people who need it at this time of the year. But I'll be back fairly soon with a new Paleo Cinema podcast and a Martian Drive-In podcast. And as I said, the Star Wars The Last Jedi review, which I've called the Star Wars Newtonmas Special, is going to be available to all people who subscribe to the podcast outside the Patreon and PayPal realms before Santa arrives. Now, if you get a lump of coal, too bad. And if you have been good, I hope you get everything you need and half of the things you want. So that's about it. And as usual, here is the credits in the style of movie credits to celebrate the wonderfulness of the people who support the podcast. I haven't updated it for the new people who support the podcast, but I will work on doing that before the next Paleo Cinema comes out. Look after yourselves. Have a great time. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, why the fuck did you choose to have Christmas in winter? It really does suck. You really should look at changing things and maybe making it in summertime, because you can have barbecues, you can go swimming, you can go away for a week or two. It's really the best. So anyway, take care of yourselves, and I'll be back soon. And of course, here are the credits. And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris our Music Director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our set and unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director. Tammy, our donut wrangler. Tim, our New York unit director. Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. Steve, our monster effects guy. Dylan, our goat wrangler. Eric, our set security lead. Richard H., the set photographer. Mark D., extra. David L., the extra. Richard C., our transportation co-captain. Carrie L., our Tasmanian consultant. And Kerry C., our accountant. We also have Sally, our continuity girl. And, of course, the other Sally, who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as a dollar per month.